We're on a mission from God.
And now for something completely different.
This is Pastor Jolly John Lekumsky.
And this is Pastor Matt Youngblood Clark. I'm coming to you from a beautiful South St. Louis where I serve at Ascension Lutheran Church as pastor.
And this is Wrestling with the Basics. And you know, last week I premiered one of my own jokes that I wrote myself. The response to it was so overwhelming, I have yet another of my own jokes.
Oh, great, John. I'm sure listeners are thrilled. Did you run this one past Lynn? Please tell me you did.
No.
Oh, no.
Well, actually, yes, I did. I told it you were, and for some reason, I got no comment.
But Uh-oh.
Here it goes. In fact, this is the story. We were delivering a get-well card to one of Lynn's dear friends, and so we didn't know, because there's stuff in it. You know how you always stick a card or whatever in it, and we weren't sure that it needed extra postage. So we went to the post office, and I noticed a big sign that said, "Keep Mercury out of the mail." And I thought, well, what about Mars? What about Jupiter and Saturn? Why are we picking on Mercury?
John. Oh, boy. We need a segment. What? John and his signs. What was it? Wasn't it last week it was some sign that misled you as well about the pennies?
Well,
rounding
right.
The pennies,
rounding,
and now you got
pennies.
Another sign,
yeah,
about Mercury's misleading
already.
You. It's,
yeah,
reading signs with Pastor John.
That's right. We'll maybe do a special episode, and then people can avoid it entirely. However, I do have something really good to share, and I hear you do too. We've kind of got into a Walther thing.
Apparently
said,
so.
Yeah, Walther. Well,
without even trying.
So here, this is the quote I want to share. Because I think this is a perfect description of what we want to do at Wrestling with the Basics.
Okay.
Now, whether we accomplish it or not, that's another story. But it's what our goal is. The task of every Christian church, and I would say also every Christian podcast, that rightly bears the name, is to provide eternal comfort. Every person has within himself an accusing conscience and longs in his heart to know his condition before the holy God. He wants to know if he, a sinner, can and will one day die a blessed death. To still this longing of man, God has established the Holy Christian Church. It should be a garden of heaven on earth, full of living springs at which the tired earthly pilgrim can rest, and that on which he can draw the comfort that heals his wounded conscience and fills him with the hope of eternal life. A church that does not provide this comfort, one that is instead like a school of morals, preaching only man's duties, awakening a servile fear of God, and leaving doubt without eternal salvation, is a church in name only. And I would certainly hope that that is what we've been doing here and will continue to do, is that we will provide comfort that is based on the foundation, Walther goes on to say, of the law and the prophets, and of course the cornerstone being Jesus Christ. So that's my editorial comment for today. You said you had a Walther quote as well, Matt.
That's great, John. Yeah, and like we talked about last week, Walther, in case people are wondering, C.F.W. Walther, the founder of sorts of our church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. My quote's a lot shorter, John.
Okay.
So, but I think it makes, you know, the same point in terms of the importance of, like you said, that cornerstone of Jesus, the gospel itself. So here's my quote. The gospel, this is from a second evening lecture.
Oh, cool.
And it's in the book, you know, The Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. The gospel does not take anything, it gives.
Oh.
You know, and I just love that. The gospel does not take anything, it gives. So the gospel, in terms of the good news of Jesus, doesn't take anything from us, right? It just gives. And what I also like about that quote is the very next line is, Walther says, "And this should make us want to jump up in joy." This should make us want to jump with joy. So yeah, thanks, Walter. I agree. Let's jump with joy over the fact that the gospel only gives.
and that is the goal of Wrestling with Basics. We hope people will jump with joy as they listen to our episodes.
Isn't it beautiful? Yeah.
Yeah. But not so much from the dumb jokes. But hopefully from the gospel, as you said.
That's right.
What's the gospel you want to share with us today, Matt?
Well, so the gospel I'd like to share today is this. I want to share an obscure ancient battle.
Oh, cool.
That no one would know about except for one reason. And then also in connection to that, this mysterious figure of sorts in the Old Testament, Melchizedek.
Okay, yes.
So John, let's read about the context around this, the battle that introduces Melchizedek. And I also want to read this just because there's some really tough Old Testament names. And anytime we can make Pastor Lukumsky read those names, it's a fun time. All right.
I'm not jumping for joy, by the way, but I will do my best.
Okay. Chapter 14, verses 1-7, John, take it away. Okay. Good luck.
In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioth, king of Elazar, Shurdaralaomer, I know I've messed up his name, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim. These kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bereshit, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemabar, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, as if that needed to be noted. And all of these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served, there it comes again, Chedorlaomer?
All right.
Okay.
But in the 13th... All right, maybe we can skip ahead here.
Okay. In the 13th year they rebelled, in the 14th year Chedorlaomer, and the kings were with him came and defeated the Rephaim, and after a Kirname, the Suzim in Ham, and even in Shavagar, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as Elpharon, on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites, who were dwelling in Hazon Tamar.
Okay. Thanks, John. What a trooper. Now, let me translate that.
Yeah, please. Please do.
There's two groups of kings, two groups of nations. Yeah. So there's these four that are from Mesopotamia, basically.
Okay.
Shedaleomer kind of seems to be the head honcho. So there's these four kings, and there's these other five kings, then these five kingdoms that are around the Jordan River, all right?
Okay.
So to the south. And what happens is these four kings from Mesopotamia, they were ruling over these five kings. But after 12 years of that, in the 13th year, the other five kings around the Jordan, they rebel. They've had enough.
Okay.
It's like they stop paying tribute. And so these four kings come down and try to beat them into submission. They fight against them. They have these battles in order to punish them for their rebellion. So there
four,
we are.
Four kings against five.
Four against five.
The Mesopotamia kings against the kings from the Jordan.
So there you go. Now, again, I was talking about this in Bible class, and I asked the question, you know, if you are reading this for the first time and you're getting all this information about these kings and this rebellion, and what would you think about it? And the one person said, blah, 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 blah. You know, you can't blame the guy for saying that. At least that was an honest answer. And it is kind of just blah, blah, blah. We would never know about these two groups of kings fighting, you know, along the Jordan River. You know, but it's in Scripture, and we'll see the reason why in just a moment. So we're going to hear about a battle now. So the next verses, they play out a battle for us. If you could read verses 8 through 12, John.
And then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. So now this is the people around the Jordan?
So these are the people that had rebelled, the five kings that had rebelled, yes.
Okay. So they went out And they joined battle in the valley of Siddim with Shador and Alomor, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amphrail, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Eleazar. Now, these are the Mesopotamia kings, I'm assuming.
Yes, yes.
Four kings against five. Now, the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way.
All right. So there we go. So it's five against four. And who wins? Well, the four kings
win.
Yeah, okay. So the four kings, the ones that have come from Mesopotamia a pretty good distance in order to squash this rebellion, they are the ones who win the battle. All right. And you get these details about the battlefield even, and as the other kings seem to be running away, some of them fall into the bitumen pits. So these are like tar pits. So it's just kind of a cool detail. So we're around the Dead Sea here, and just kind of interesting. Apparently, the Dead Sea even occasionally has asphalt-type chunks floating in
really?
It.
Really?
Because of the tar in the area.
Yep, yeah.
So even still today, you know, you get a little bit of that too. There you go. There's the battle. But here's why this makes it into the Bible and why we're talking about this, 4,000 years later on Wrestling with the Basics. Verse 12. So they take the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, but they also took
Lot,
Abraham's nephew. And so if you're going to mess with Lot, you're also messing with Abram. And this is why it's in the Bible. Now, Abraham gets involved. And I just kind of think it speaks to the fact that, again, you know, the Bible and specifically the book of Genesis, boy, chock full of history, but it's history with a purpose. You know, it's a history that's centered in on this lineage, this line of Abram and his descendants, because it's all focused on Jesus. And the one through whom, through Abraham, will be born. So when this battle intersects with Abraham's life, now it's worth recording. And we'll see some other reasons as we go along the way, too. So.
And I love these kind of historical things because they're a reminder that God's at work in our world, too. Because we could do the same thing. We could list the names of the kings, Zelensky and Putin and whoever the guy is now in control of Iran. And it's a reminder, no, these may seem like they're just random events taking place, but no, God's hand is at work in all of these things as well.
Yes, just as much as it was, 4,000 years ago with this battle.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may not be looking like God is in control, because if God's in control, then why does Lot get taken off and kidnapped? But a lot of things happen in our world too, but it's still God who ultimately will make everything work together for good.
Yeah, and I think that's something to look at in this account in particular is, how does God then make this defeat and this kidnapping, this taking away of Lot and his possessions, how does God work this for good? And I think that's something to keep in mind as we read on. All right, well, let's read verses 13 through 16 if we could, John.
Then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and Anor, and they were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsman had been taken captive, he led forth his trained man, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people.
All right, there we go. So now we see how Abram gets involved. So someone escapes, tells Abram what happened. It's interesting. It's called Abram the Hebrew.
Yeah.
The name Hebrew means to cross over, to pass over.
Oh.
And so he had passed over in his travels. Over the Euphrates and elsewhere, and now here he is to pass over. That was kind of a nomadic type of aspect to it too. right? He's a herdsman. He's passing around, passing over different places as he cares for his herds. But anyway.
And also, Matt, it reminds us that he's an outsider here.
Yeah.
Because you talked about that the last time, too. His people know he's an outsider.
They use this descriptor for him. Yeah, exactly. Oh. That's good. So Abram hears about this, and then he has 318 trained men born in his house. I mean, that's interesting. Very specific number, 318. Yeah. So, I mean, he goes and pursues these four kings with just 318 guys. On the one hand, it sounds like a lot of people. Wow, that's a lot of trained men to have in your household. But on the other hand, if you're pursuing four kings who have already defeated, and you read all their different victories already, John, as painful as it was, thanks again for doing that. Is Abram going to be able to pull this off with just 318 guys? And the answer is, well, if the Lord's on your side, if the Lord's fighting for you, you bet, right? And he does.
That's a constant theme through the entirety of the Old Testament, that where there is victory, it's never because of men, it's because of the Lord, which certainly directs to us in our faith today, that if we are saved, it's not because we were able to gather together forces that are so powerful, but it's because we have the ultimate force, and that is God and his love.
Yeah, exactly. And, we could spend a whole episode just talking about that. And, one of the examples that comes to my mind is Gideon, remember, in the Old Testament.
Oh, yeah.
And, he's the Midianites, I believe, is who they're battling at the time. And he has 32,000 men. And then God causes him to whittle it down to just 300. I wonder what Gideon was thinking. Lord, are you sure about this? 32,000 sounded pretty good. And yet the point is, like you said, to show that the victory is the Lord's, not Gideon's, not these men. And we could think of other examples. Think of David and Goliath, right? David even confesses that on the battlefield, that no, the victory is because of the Lord as he battles this champion Goliath. And then, of course, the ultimate example then, like you said, is the gospel itself. Jesus, that on the cross of all things, this thing of weakness and death becomes the very thing by which we have victory and the forgiveness of sins.
And that's the difficult spot that God finds himself in. I hope you appreciate how hard it is to be God. Well, because on the one hand, God wants to give us victory, right? Why wouldn't he give victory to those who are his people? But the problem is, because of our sinfulness, it seems like every time we get a victory, we begin to think it's all about us and about what we're doing. And so that's this constant tension where God has to discipline us because he loves us, not because he hates us. And yet, on the other hand, always assuring us, just stick around, hold on, keep faith, because in the end, he will make everything, even our defeats, turn out to be good, as he did with Jesus Christ, who everyone thought, he's done for. He's dead and in a tomb. But found out real soon that that wasn't the truth at all. Yeah.
Yeah. That defeat of Jesus, what seems to be the defeat of Jesus, right? Looks, God works for good. Here's the defeat of Lot, of the Sodom kings, and yet God works for good. And he begins to work for good as then Abram brings back all the possessions and also his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and people. So, I mean, I got to think Abram was a hero. He's bringing back women and children and not just Lot, but everyone who had been taken captive and all the stuff, too.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable that everything, including the possessions, you think at least something would have been lost.
Yeah. So here we go then. We want to get to Melchizedek, John. And let's read verses. Let's see. We're going to do verses 17 through 20, if we could.
Okay. And after his return from the defeat of Chedorboy and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shava, that is the king's valley, and Melchizedek, which is also a really hard word to pronounce, but we say that a lot. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought up bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Is that enough?
That's good for now. Yeah. So, yeah, this is an interesting thing. This is really all we've got about Melchizedek in Genesis, John. These few verses, he shows up in Psalm 110. And then in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews makes a big deal about the guy. Huh. He goes on for over a chapter talking about Melchizedek. So who is this Melchizedek anyway? He meets Abram there, all right, in the King's Valley. And Melchizedek is, one, he's a king, the king of Salem. And the word Salem means peace. And some believe that perhaps Salem is another name for Jerusalem, the city of peace. Okay. And then two, he also is a priest of the Most High God. So he really is a priest of the real God, you know, not just some pagan gods, right? So he has this twofold office of priest and king. But what's kind of interesting, he just kind of shows up out of nowhere, right, John? We really don't know anything else about the guy.
Yeah.
But Luther speculated on who it might be, who Melchizedek might be. Do you remember Luther suggests?
No, I don't remember that.
So he suggests, and this name came up in our last episode.
Yeah.
He suggests it might be Shem, Noah's son.
Okay. Yeah.
And when you do the math, it could be. At least he was alive. He lived 600 years, and so his life overlapped with Abraham's life. So who knows? Maybe it could have been. You know, Luther says, he says, you know, it boils down for Luther. It doesn't matter who it is, really. But he does say, consider what kind of ruler Shem was, if he was Melchizedek. He was a holy survivor of the flood. Without a doubt, Shem often brought this sad example of God's wrath to the attention of his people. This holy and venerable old man, the people of Salem chose to be their king. So Luther suggests that. And I guess there's some Jewish tradition to that, too. That suggestion, but old Shem, let's make him king. You know, after all, he knows what life was like even before the flood. So maybe not. But what is interesting is, you know, so who is greater, Melchizedek or Abraham? You know, Father Abraham, he's a great guy, but who's greater? You know, as you read, Melchizedek blesses Abraham. You know, so who's greater, the one who blesses or the one who's being blessed?
Well, certainly the one who's blessing. Yeah. And it just occurred to me from what we talked about last week, you know, my wife Lynn pointed out that this would have been Abram's great, great, great grandfather. I don't know how many generations.
Yeah.
But they would have been related. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so the greater one is Melchizedek, as he blesses Abraham. And then also, Abraham gives him a tenth of everything, kind of this offering.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Who's greater, the one who gives the offering or receives the offering? Well, the one who receives it, right?
Yeah.
And so Melchizedek certainly greater here than Abraham, which kind of just adds to the mystery, right, of who this Melchizedek is. Melchizedek has something to say. And again, he says, blessed be Abraham, by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So who does he give credit for winning the battle? The Lord.
God. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not about Abraham.
It's not about Shem or Melchizedek either, because they're just the priests of the God Most High.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the writer of Hebrews then, John, he runs with this then, and he talks about this comparison between Melchizedek and Jesus.
Okay.
So, you know, can you see any parallels between Melchizedek and Jesus, even from just the text here in Genesis?
Well, because, I mean, to me, the clearest would be the fact that Jesus is the one that brings the blessing of God Most High to us.
Yeah. So Melchizedek blesses Abraham. Jesus brings about the blessing, makes possible the blessing even for us. Yeah. Another one is Melchizedek, priest and king.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Jesus, priest, and king, and prophet. We'll throw that in there too. But he's more than just a king. He's more than just a priest. We see that too. The other thing that the writer of Hebrews brings up is, you know, you almost get the impression as he writes to Hebrews that some might objected him to Jesus being called a high priest, right? Because what tribe is Jesus from? He's from the tribe of
Judah.
Judah, and the priests are from
Levites.
The tribe of Levi, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the writer of Hebrews points out, well, Melchizedek, what tribe is he from? Trick question,
know.
Right?
A trick question, I don't know.
Yeah, this is before there are any tribes, right?
Ah,
so this
okay.
This is the time of Abraham, so we don't even have the 12 tribes yet, and yet he's a priest. So he's not a priest after Levi or Aaron. No, he's just a priest. And so the writer of Hebrews makes the point that, you know, Jesus isn't a priest because he's a Levite or a descendant of the first high priest, Aaron. No, he just is. And so he's called a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And that's what Psalm 110 actually says. That one verse where he shows up, Melchizedek, it says, you are a priest forever in the order after the order of Melchizedek. And then ultimately that's fulfilled in Jesus, that he is this priest in the line of Melchizedek. Yeah. So anyway, just a little insight into this Melchizedek character and comparisons between Melchizedek and Jesus. So Melchizedek, let's be clear, real guy. He's not just some angel or the angel of the Lord that came out of heaven. He's a real man who was really a king in a real place called Salem. And yet he is a foreshadowing, a type of Jesus in terms especially of his role as high priest, as then that unfolds in the book of Hebrews and in the New Testament. So just a little introduction to Melchizedek and the connection to Jesus.
And I think the thing it should say to all of us that when we read the Bible, we need to do two things. We need to find ourselves in the Bible. When we read these stories of these Old Testament saints, all of whom are sinners, by the way, that is recorded over and over again. And of course, we should learn from that we are sinners too. And of course, as we read from these great, we see the victories that God gives to people like Abram. And we should remember, yeah, God's going to do the same thing for us. Not that we won't have trials, because that's the other thing, right? These guys are constantly having problems. But God will give us deliverance. And certainly that will be finally accomplished when we die and God takes us to be with our loved ones in heaven. But then the other thing, too, is just like the author of Hebrews, we need to be finding Jesus all the time in the text, too. And it is interesting that the Bible can say, pinpoint Melchizedek and say, yeah, here's a type. Or it's the anti-type, isn't it? I can't remember which is which. I think he's a type of Jesus as prophet and priest, or priest and king, rather.
Yeah, John, I completely agree. And I think, too, it's an example that, you know, some of those unclear things in the Old Testament, read the New Testament, because it helps to unpack that. It helps to bring those things to light. And like you said, it helps us ultimately see where Jesus is, even in the Old Testament scriptures.
So thank you for listening to us. This has been Wrestling with the Basics.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to KFUO.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to KFUO.org/store.